From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. You're listening to Idaho Matters. The U.S. Supreme Court was dubbed the least dangerous branch of government by Alexander Hamilton. However, the court has lately been in the middle of some of America's biggest controversies, from laws around abortion and gun rights to voting rights and religion, all the way to gerrymandering and presidential power. And all of these issues have a direct impact on our lives. Dr. David Adler is the president of the Alturas Institute, which is a nonprofit that works to promote the Constitution, gender equality, and civic education. He has been immersed in the Supreme Court for much of his career, and in fact, he'll be talking about the court on Thursday at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute. Dr. Adler is joining us today to talk more about all of this. Dr. Adler, it's nice to have you back on the program.
Thanks very much for having me. It's good to be with you again.
So, Dr. Adler, there were several long-reaching decisions that came out of the Supreme Court just last year. What were the top two or three in your mind, and why? I would assume one being the overturning of Roe v. Wade.
That's right, Gemma. The reality is that the court hurt itself as an institution very badly last term when it did strike down Roe versus Wade, despite the fact that a great majority of the American people supported Roe, even some public opinion polls showing that that support exceeded 70%. And that created a great gulf between the court and the public, which the judicial scholars have long known represents a terrific threat against the court's legitimacy. And that's why I think nationally so many are calling into question the court as a legitimate branch of government, not because of its authority, but because of its behavior. So that's one case. The second, among others, I would say, falls in the area of religion, where the court significantly reduced the wall separating church and state by upholding a statute in Maine that requires people to pay support for those students who will attend parochial schools. And of course, in the infamous case coming out of the state of Washington, upholding the right of a school official to conduct prayers on the 50-yard line at football games, thus reducing the wall between separation of church and state, because that can be seen quite clearly as the state's promotion of religion. And both of those decisions, then, the Dobbs case and these religious rulings, fly in the face of long-held precedents. And so Americans are increasingly worried about the importance of precedent in American law and whether the court will pay due respect to, in fact, precedent, which is the backbone of American law.
So, Dr. Adler, you know, I mentioned that in the beginning of this, that Alexander Hamilton said that the U.S. Supreme Court, this branch of government, was the least divisive. It was the least dangerous branch of government. And yet, you know, there are arguments that it's like, well, you know, the Supreme Court kind of it ebbs and it flows. I mean, there have been times where the Supreme Court in its history has been more liberal leaning. That's how Roe was able to be established in 1973. And yet, when we look back ideologically, there are many scholars that say, well, but the court has not been this conservative in 90 years. My question to you is, why should the court even be looked at as being more liberal or more conservative? Isn't the whole point of the Supreme Court to be neutral?
Those are excellent questions. Thank you. The reality here is that Americans expect the court to stand above the political fray. That certainly is what Alexander Hamilton expected when he wrote Federalist 78 and dubbed the court the least dangerous branch, primarily because it would not have the power of the sword, it could not enforce its decisions, and certainly it lacked the power of the purse. It lacked funding. So the reality here is that there was always the expectation from the beginning that the court would stand above the fray, even though we know, as you pointed out, that that's not historically true. The court tends to ebb and flow. Characterizing the court as liberal and conservative is really a shorthand way of describing the views reflected in Supreme Court opinions that correlate with those political views held throughout the country. It's never been a really good way of describing the work of the court. But the reality here is that in the 1930s, we saw the court behave in such a way under the leadership of the so-called Four Horsemen, the conservative Four Horsemen, in a way that put it at odds with the majority of the country and created this gulf between the court and public opinion. Now, it's not necessarily the case that the court's opinion should always reflect public opinion, and indeed, there are a good many cases to indicate that it should not. But generally speaking, democracy is in trouble when the court is far removed from public opinion, as it is on the abortion issue now, as it was in the 1930s. And that grave separation between public opinion and the court's rulings is what inspired President Roosevelt's court packing plan in 1936 and amounted to an all-out attack on the court. At that point, as judicial scholars pointed out, the court had to be very careful about removing itself so far from public opinion, lest it loses credibility. And so, as you pointed out, now this current court is viewed as ultra-conservative, in large part because this court, I think, is trying to promote a far-right agenda, which its advocates tried to accomplish at the polls and did pursue those goals for many years, but were unsuccessful, meaning the only way to achieve these goals was at the Supreme Court. And that's why the nominations by President Trump of three ultra-right conservatives, combined with what people will remember as the refusal of the Senate to hear President Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland in 2016, has brought such a political overtone to this court that we are saying, as you pointed out, that this has not been true in 90 years. And the kinds of cases that the court is hearing and will hear now the rest of this term promise to add fuel to that fire.
Well, and I think it's worth pointing out that the U.S. Supreme Court decides what cases they're going to hear or not hear. So that would then, Dr. Adler, in your opinion, it sounds like, play a role in what cases they choose to take up based on where the court is leaning.
That's an excellent point. The reality is that the court's ability to pick and choose has unfortunately tended to remove the court from its historic role as a law court and contributed to its growing image as a public policy court, that it makes public policy. And this is unfortunate because, as listeners may know, until 1925, the court just heard the cases coming before it on appeal. Beginning in 1925, when Congress passed a statute authorizing the court to select the cases it wants to hear within certain restraints and under some compulsions, the court increasingly has exercised its authority in order to promote public policies that reflect its view. And that's what's occurring now in the case of abortion, in religion, in gun rights, LGBT rights, and other areas as well. And I think it serves to undermine the court's exercise of this discretionary authority, serves to undermine its publicly held image as a court that stands above the fray.
And then the argument could be made, though, as well, Dr. Adler, that it is also not the Supreme Court's role to make the law. That should be left up to Congress. And so here we are in this position right now. Let's take the overturning of Roe v. Wade. The U.S. Supreme Court decided that, you know, there it could be overturned. And there are people saying, well, then Congress should have done something about this. Congress should have put a law on the books. So how does that also play into the Supreme Court?
You're certainly right. The Congress, under Democratic control years ago, should have passed a nationwide statute, effectively writing Roe versus Wade into our national code. And I'm sure that Democrats regret deeply that they did not. On the other hand, this court's shift to applying what it now likes to describe as an emphasis on history and tradition is way to promote its own interests, particularly those among the six. And overturning Roe versus Wade undermined its own self-styled description of applying to history and tradition in the area of abortion rights, because Roe was 50 years old. And if you go all the way back to the founding of this nation, state laws, Gemma, permitted abortion up until the point of quickening. It was not treated as a felony, in some cases at the most as a misdemeanor. There was an understanding at our founding, that occasionally women might decide that they needed to pursue the performance of an abortion. So history and tradition then, unfortunately, is becoming, I think, with this court, a way of cherry picking.
Can we talk about some of the cases that are set to be heard this session? One being that the court is considering another gay marriage related case, but instead of baking cakes for a gay wedding, the case this time, it's a website designer who's saying that she does not want to make a website for same-sex weddings, that she will not do this. So with that said, can you talk about the intersection of gay rights versus free speech, but also gay rights versus religious freedom?
Sure. This is a complex intersection of conflicting rights, as you've pointed out. In this particular case, at issue is a Colorado anti-discrimination law, which, among other things, prohibits private businesses from practicing discrimination based on sexual orientation, religion, color, and so forth. This case that you've just mentioned involves the issue of whether a website builder who is an evangelical Christian can assert what she asserts is a fundamental religious belief that, in fact, marriage is legitimate only if it's between a man and a woman, thus contending a religious right to refuse to build a website for gay couples, in addition to asserting a free speech right. This case is being billed as a free speech case, particularly in view of the fact that it's an exercise in artistic expression. So that kind of hybrid claim, free speech and religious rights, are being used against the state, which wants to prohibit discrimination against members of the LGBT community. This is a great clash then between highly valued, indeed fundamental rights in our Constitution. And it will be left to the court now to try to decide which of those rights should be granted primary importance and which should be relegated to residual importance. My own view is that given this court's recent rulings on religious matters, that it's likely to uphold the religious rights of this website builder to declare that she does not have to build a website for a gay couple.
Dr. Adler, if we truly believe that there is supposed to be a separation of church and state in this country, then doesn't that then go to the fact that if this is her religious belief, shouldn't she be able to decide if she doesn't want to do that, whether the majority disagrees with her belief system?
That, of course, is the point she's asserting. And then that raises the issue of the breadth, the scope of every individual liberty. We all know that no right is absolute, whether it's free speech or freedom of religion. And so the concern here is that if this website builder should prevail, that it may open the door to further discrimination based on artistic expression and religious beliefs, to discrimination against all kinds of people in society, hearkening back to a religious right to discriminate against Black Americans and to deny their services. So the court is going to be interpreting the Civil Rights Act of 1964, Section 7, Title 7, to determine whether or not artistic expression is exempt from those exercises that engage in discrimination against persons of color or based on sexual orientation, for example.
I know other cases they're going to be looking at are student loan forgiveness, as well as affirmative action and college admissions. Can you quickly talk about the affirmative action and college admissions? Because this is something that could impact numerous people.
Well, that's true. The Harvard admissions policy, which currently allows admissions committees to take account of race, not a dominating factor, but to take account of it, is at issue here, as the claim has been made that the application of affirmative action policies represents discrimination in these cases of Asian American students. If this court knocks down the Harvard policy, this would well sound the death knell for affirmative action in this country. So the eyes of the nation are upon this case. This current court seems not to be very warm to the continuation of affirmative action. And indeed, during oral argument, one of the conservative justices cited Justice O'Connor's opinion 25 years ago in a University of Michigan affirmative action case, in which she said, "I hope that in 25 years, affirmative action programs will no longer be necessary." Here we are on the 25th anniversary of Justice O'Connor's wish. The case involving the loan forgiveness program draws great attention to the issue of presidential power, as it involves a president's interpretation of a federal law that grants broad authority to the Department of Education to provide forgiveness options to those students who have endured very high levels of federal loans at a time when the country was gripped by the pandemic, people losing their jobs, people losing their apartments, etc. And President Biden, like President Trump before him, issued a pause on the requirement of those who are participants in the program to repay their debts. He went one step further and said that, in fact, there would be a loan forgiveness program for some 40 million people, adding up perhaps to $20,000 per person in various cases. Lower courts have held that the president exceeded his statutory authority. The administration, the Biden administration, on the other hand, is holding that the president indeed was granted broad authority during national emergencies to alter the repayment program. And that has been the argument made by the Solicitor General. This is a closely watched case. A lot of money is on the line. And the broader public policy question is, what happens to Americans during a national emergency when they are just clobbered financially? Are there no legal tools for the administration in the application of a statute to spare them further financial misery? Historically, 90 years ago, for example, the Supreme Court did find wiggle room in a statute to forgive the precise terms that people were held to pay on their mortgages in the depths of the Depression. So the court, Gemma, has latitude. It could lean on a precedent in the 1930s to uphold this exercise of broad statutory authority to protect millions of Americans, young Americans, from further financial calamity.
Are you at all concerned about how these cases will impact the Bill of Rights?
I am very much, because what we're talking about here, as your questions have raised, we're talking about critical free speech rights. We're talking about religious claims. We're talking about due process. We're talking about the fundamental rights of the LGBT community, and the Second Amendment, which we haven't even gotten to. So the Bill of Rights is very much center stage before the Supreme Court this very term. And depending how the court interprets the statutes or the constitutional provisions at issue in the coming months, will have a huge impact on how we go forward with an understanding of what free speech means, what religious freedom means, what does protection from discrimination mean, and of course, abortion, very much always in upper mind in the minds of tens of millions of Americans. The court is engaged in a process of rewriting the Bill of Rights, and it's not clear just how far this court will go, because if you recall, in the aftermath of the outrage following the Dobbs decision, many mm-hmm. pointed to Justice Clarence Thomas's concurring opinion, in which he targeted particular fundamental rights, including privacy, as those which the court should reconsider. And so we wondered, after the Dobbs decision, what happens to the fundamental right of privacy and autonomy? And we are now seeing, perhaps, or at least glimpsing, what the court intends to do with these fundamental rights this very term.
Well, Dr. Adler, as always, so appreciate your time and the conversation.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you, as always. Thank you, Gemma.
We've been speaking with Dr. David Adler. He is the president of the Alturas Institute. He'll be talking about the U.S. Supreme Court this Thursday at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute in Boise. We will put a link with more information on our website, boisestatepublicradio.org. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
This new year, LifeKit wants to help you succeed, because everyone needs a little help being human.
It can seem so overwhelming. You're not alone.
Who can I commit to being?
If you want to do something, then just do it. Just take that first step.
Great advice every week. Listen to LifeKit from NPR.